I'm still Joan Hunt. And we are today reaching the, I haven't decided whether to call it the hard core or the soft center, the heart of the book of Revelation in chapters 10 through 14. I've compared Revelation, the book of Revelation, to a movie that you watch that won't be the same by the time you've come to the end of the movie. And it has features like science fiction books that are rather fantastic characters who put on screen in front of us emotionally true symbols of what's happening in our lives so that we can figure out who we are, where we are, what is the meaning of the direction that we're going, and what God is calling us to do and be in times like these. We start the movie kind of saying, gosh, these are terrible times. For the people at the time of Revelation, they were terrible times because the Roman Empire was oppressive, tyrannical, brutal, ruling the world with a sword, and requiring everyone to worship their system. It wasn't just the political system of the time, it was also the religious system of the time, the social system, and held all the economic strings. So unless you were part and parcel of the Roman system, you could be disenfranchised of your power to own property, to buy and to sell, and if you refused to worship or acknowledge the power of the emperor, you could also be killed. And the Christian church was wondering, in a situation like this, what do we do? What is it that we stand for? Do we stand for a clear alternative to the tyranny of the Roman Empire? Or maybe should we fit in with the system and find ways to cooperate and, you know, it's not that big a deal. To John of Patmos, he wasn't from Patmos. Patmos was a prisoner of war exile site off the coast of Turkey, a small island about 5 miles by 10 miles. To John, writing to seven churches in western Turkey, the situation was very critical. And he thought that at all costs they should avoid compromising with the Roman Empire. Because to participate in the Roman Empire system and to approve of it was to deny their baptism, and it was also to be part of a system that was, as I said, based on the sword and violence and worship of a false authority, rather than a system that would be based on what the prophets had proclaimed through the Old Testament, what Jesus had taught and lived and died and been raised for. A community of love, peace, caring, sharing, mutual concern for one another, empowerment of those who had no power, giving voice to those who had no voice. And so for John, writing from Patmos, the stakes were very high. But he realized that as he wrote to these congregations in western Turkey, he was writing to people whose knees were increasingly weak, and who felt, who felt a lot of different feelings. Some of them had compromised with the Roman system without giving it a second thought, and thought they'd found their way to work in the system and to take care of their families and to make their money, and, you know, so what was the big deal? And others of them were feeling the pains of persecution, but were fearing the possible death that lay before them and wondering if really they could be strong enough to give a witness that far that would last even to death. And so the images that John has in this imaginative book of Revelation is a way of reinterpreting the life situation for the people in Turkey so that they can see who the enemy really is, where the truth really lies, that the enemy really is, although it may have full-blown power in the world right now, it can't last because it's not founded on truth and it's not founded on God. And that the power to give a witness, even to death, is power and is worth doing and can change the world. And whether it changes the world or not, we'll give a witness to the one who can change the world and will change the world when the time is ripe for that. And John does this through these wonderful, huge, flamboyant symbols in the book of Revelation. We're going to start now with the heart, the centerpiece, right where the story turns, because this is the revelation, in the middle of Revelation, of what the whole thing is about. And that is in chapter 11, verses 15 to 19. I've drawn a key above the heart because this is the key to the book of Revelation. If you're wondering, what is all this stuff about? You can go back to this section and read it and try to get clear in your mind what's being accomplished here, and then apply that to the section you're confused about. It's the spectacles or the lenses that you can look at the whole book of Revelation through. And what I would like us to do is read this section of Revelation aloud together. I know we have some different translations of the Bible, and we won't worry about that. We'll just read this section with grandeur and magnificence, because it is a grand and magnificent section. Chapter 11, verses 15 to 19. Then the seventh angel blew his trumpet, and there were loud voices in heaven saying, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Messiah, and he will reign forever and ever." Then the 24 elders who sit on the throne before God fell on their faces and worshiped God, singing, "We give you thanks, Lord God Almighty, who are and who was, for you have taken your great power and begun to reign. The nations raged, but your wrath has come, and the time for judging the dead, for rewarding your servants, the prophets, the saints, and all who fear your name, both small and great, and for destroying those who destroy the earth." Then God's temple in heaven was opened, and the ark of his covenant was seen within his temple, and there were flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and earthquake, and heavy hail. Let's start from verse 19 and work back through this. Verse 19 tells us what? Old Testament ears open up at this, and we say, lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, earthquake, heavy hail. This is an epiphany of God, like on Mount Sinai. Something significant is happening here. This is a major revelation. God's temple in heaven was opened. This reminds me of the death of Jesus, when the temple curtain was ripped open. This is God's truth for the world. The Ark of the Covenant is seen within the temple. The Ark of the Covenant carries the marks of the promise that God made to the people, that God will never abandon them, but God will be their people forever, will be their God forever and ever, and they'll be God's people forever and ever. This is God's solid and sure promise, an eternal promise from beginning to the end of time. And what's happening? The nations are raging, verse 18 says, but God has made a response. Your wrath has come, and the time for judging the dead, for rewarding your servants, the prophets and the saints and all who fear your name, both small and great, both people who do it publicly and grandly, and also the little ones, the frightened ones in Thyatira and Sardis and Laodicea, who are wondering how to make a witness, who serve, who fear God's name, and the time also for destroying those who destroy the earth. God is not going to let the destruction of the earth that Rome is perpetrating continue, but the destroyers will be destroyed. So, this is the key to Revelation and what it's all about. God is judging the dead. While I write this, start a discussion. What good does it do to judge the dead? Do you have any ideas?
Justice. In the end, justice, even though the schmucky ones, the oppressors, might have had power during their lifetime, they'll get it sooner or later. And the innocent martyrs will get theirs too.
More ideas?
Directs them to the right place.
This is the right time to direct them to the right place, because it's too late to change the record of their life on earth, right? So this is the appropriate time for that to happen. Yeah. If the dead are being judged, in some sense they're not dead any longer. And so death doesn't have the last word. Anything else? So there's something there to say that God is the one who has the last and the appropriate and the timely word. There's something there to encourage all of us who are struggling to be faithful. And there's something there to give us hope that evil will not continue and that those who are destroying the world will be destroyed. How else is evil going to stop? But the destruction of destruction really is the beginning of new creation or the possibility for a new future. And the response in heaven to this is a proclamation or a vision in heaven, but you know, heaven is where they know what the truth really is, what's going on behind the scenes. And so when this is sung, one of those freedom songs that is there to inspire the people of God to help us keep going and to make the oppressors angry because they can't understand where the source of our joy comes from. The response in heaven is to the elders fall on their faces and worship God and sing. And loud voices in heaven saying, the kingdom of the world, even this world here where God's hand is often invisible and the will of God may seem confusing or shadowy, hard to discern. The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. And you can hear Handel's chorus, but he shall reign forever and ever. So there it is. That's what Revelation is about. Now we're going to look out from this section and come to some of the most colorful characters in Revelation today. Because what surrounds the center section is, in chapter 10, the seer John, the prophet John, receives a sweet and a bitter scroll from an angel so big that the angel can stand simultaneously in the sea and on the earth. The sweet and bitter scroll is an open one. We're not going to look at this closely, so I'll tell you some things about it right now. That he eats, which is Old Testament students, like in the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel was given a scroll to eat. The scroll tasted sweet, but was bitter to his stomach. John has the same experience. He's being commissioned or recommissioned as a prophet, just the way Ezekiel was. John was commissioned at the beginning of the book to see these visions and record them and pass them on. Now he's being recommissioned. And why is the scroll sweet and bitter? Usually people say it's sweet because it's the word of God, but it's bitter because it's the word of judgment. Then a vision that he sees is of two witnesses, and I hope we'll have time to come back to them. This is a portion of Revelation that many people are not familiar with because it's almost totally opaque until you go through it and put some of the clues together. And yet it's a very encouraging part to God's people who have a witness to make in difficult times. That's the section we already looked at. Then more visions. They add up to seven, although John doesn't sit there and say the first thing I saw, the second thing I saw, the third thing I saw, but a wonderful number seven, that means a fullness or a completeness. And the visions include scenes of a woman being tormented by a dragon or being pursued by a dragon, of two beasts, one that rises out of the sea and one that rises out of the earth. And then a vision of the redeemed on Mount Zion with the Lamb. Three angels who proclaim three blanket statements to the world. A call for the endurance of the saints. And then two visions of harvesting the earth or of judgment. The last one is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. That's where that comes from. I don't know if we'll be able to look at that more closely or not, because I want to start with the woman and the dragon, chapter 12. Somebody please read verses 1 through 6.
A great portent appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pangs, in the agony of giving birth. Then another portent appeared in heaven, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 diadems on his heads. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. Then the dragon stood before the woman who was about to bear a child, so that he might devour her child as soon as it was born. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who was to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was snatched away and taken to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, so that there she can be nourished for 1,260 days.
Thank you.
Who do you think the woman is? What are the clues we have about her? A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. 12 disciples, tribes, particularly the tribes. So, who is this woman?
Israel.
Uh-huh. The true Israel, the spiritual Israel, not just literal Israel. We're not talking Jewish people here. We're talking the faithful people of God. And who's the dragon? Let's, for a minute, yeah, good. Let's look at the description of the dragon. It's a red dragon with 7 heads. Very intelligent, I guess, huh? completeness of intelligence. This is a smart beast we're dealing with here. 7 heads, 10 horns. Horns are power. Horns are things you can attack with. 10 horns might be, well, ten, very strong, 10 horns. And 7 diadems on his heads. So authority, power, earthly power with the diadems or the crowns that he's wearing. A cosmic dragon, his tail sweeps down a third of the stars of heaven and throws them to the earth. I don't care about stars, poof. I don't care about the earth where the stars will land. Standing before the woman who's about to bear a child in order to eat the child. Who's the child? She gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. Old Testament students say, oh, this is Psalm 2, verse 9. a prophecy of the Messiah, who is to rule the nations with a rod of iron. So who's the child?
Jesus.
Christ. And the true Israel, the church, is the one that gives birth to Christ in the world, and this dragon is waiting to gobble up that child as soon as it's born. Who's the dragon?
Satan.
Satan. Mm-hmm. In case we didn't know that, look down at verse 9. It's perfectly clear. The great dragon was thrown down. That ancient serpent, Old Testament students, the story of the fall, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. I mean, in case you wonder, there it is, kind of hammered, nailed down right there. That's who the dragon is. Giving birth, a person, a woman, is very vulnerable. It's to bring life, new life into the world, to bring hope and a new beginning into the world. One makes oneself very vulnerable. When I was giving birth, I remember I wanted to wear certain earrings. I was real sentimental about all this. And eventually the point came where I threw the earrings off, and I could have been in the middle of the street, and it wouldn't have mattered a bit to me because I had work to do and I was doing it. Who is going to defend this woman? How is she going to be protected? Well, God immediately takes the child away. There's the sign of divine providence. And the woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God so she can be nourished for 1,260 days. We'll come back to that number in a minute because it reappears. What does wilderness mean to us people who are listening with Old Testament ears?
Place of testing.
A place of testing and also, in hindsight, a place of revelation and a place where it turns out the people, after they'd escaped from slavery in Egypt, were in a very special relationship with God because although it was a hard place to live, they were protected, guided, fed by manna and quail. And so it turned out to be a very blessed time, although a difficult time of trial. What does that mean for us in Thyatira as we hear this? The church is protected in the wilderness. Can our times of tribulation and trouble and testing be a time of a special blessing? Unthinkable, but well, maybe it'll turn out to be true if we get through this. Well, then, war breaks out in heaven in verse 7. Which is, for me, a sign that if God's people on earth are suffering, God is not going to sit silently by. But even heaven can be disrupted by this war. God is on the side of the church and of the people who are suffering and of those who have no voice, and will fight the battle that needs to be fought. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon and his angels fought back, but they were defeated. As easy as that. This doesn't go on for chapters and chapters telling us the ins and outs of all this fight. Immediately we know the dragon and his angels were defeated. So the outcome is certain. God has the power to prevail and uses the power to prevail over Satan. And Satan and his angels are cast to earth. Now, there's still battles ahead. There's still campaigns to be won. But the outcome of the war is certain. Everything else, somebody says, is a mopping up operation. Doesn't mean it's easy to go through, but we already know what the outcome will be. Does that give us more hope, people of Thyatira? Mm-hmm.
Do the crowns on the head of the dragon indicate the enthronement of his power on earth somehow, or what?
Sounds like a good bet to me, yeah. And so when the dragon and his angels are thrown down to earth, then a loud voice in heaven, verse 10, proclaims another wonderful song, another freedom song. That reminds us of the end of the story. Someone quoted Dan Berrigan in here the other day, the priest who repeatedly does demonstrations against the nuclear industry. Well, he's poured blood on the nose cones of nuclear missiles and that kind of thing. Someone says, how can you keep on doing this year after year after year and being imprisoned year after year after year, and it doesn't make any difference? And Dan Berrigan said, well, I know the end of the story. And knowing the end of the story, we sing these kinds of songs to keep us empowered in the middle of the story. Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our comrades has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. Accuser is what Satan means. But they've conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. For they did not cling to life even in the face of death. Even if it goes so far that your life is called for. It's said of these people that they conquered by dying, which sounds like a contradiction in terms, but somehow there's that Christian truth that death brings life. And Ellen Bosak in South Africa, writing about Revelation, quotes a book by Alan Payton in which a cautious middle-aged black man belatedly joins the struggle for freedom in South Africa. To his bemused white friend, he explains, when I go up there to heaven, which is my intention, the big judge in heaven will say to me, where are your wounds? And if I say I haven't any, he will say, wasn't there anything to fight for? So, my question to you right now is, what do you think is worth fighting for? Where do you draw the line? At what point would it be said about you that you did not cling to life even in the face of death, but that you conquered Satan by the blood of the Lamb and the word of your testimony? And you may think of that either as an individual or as the witness you wish the people of God as a community would make. Where do you think we ought to draw the line?
I think freedom. We say peace, but I think freedom is where I'd have to.
That's worth going all the way for. What kind of freedom do you mean?
Well, first to worship, but to believe.
Religious freedom is worth dying for.
Of course, we can go through the whole thing of speech and
free speech is worth dying for.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm not sure how far I go. I think I'll say my faith, religion, and I'm not sure how far I go. Yeah.
Other lines. Where would others of you draw the line, or where have you drawn the line?
their children were threatened.
So we protect our children.
What do you mean by fight? Are we talking about violence here, or are we talking about my thesis on the door? Or?
Yeah, in terms of Revelation, I'm not talking about fighting. It'll come up a little bit later. Those who live by the sword perish by the sword. So I'm talking about a witness even unto death.
Yes.
Or civil disobedience.
Oh, you're not talking about
risk.
Or, yeah, or laying down your life, but not necessarily taking up arms. And, you know, that would be another conversation. And if you want to talk about what's worth fighting for, taking up arms, that's all right with me too. Because the question I want to know is, what's worth dying for? What cannot be tolerated?
Someone who would keep us from expressing our faith, and also someone who would try to keep us from expressing our faith to those of the next generation, or discouraging them. That's worth dying for.
Mm-hmm. So the heritage of our faith and the ability to pass it on to our children and grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Another way to get at this question is to say, what are you angry about? What are you outraged about in the world?
The destruction of the earth.
The destruction of the earth. Mm-hmm. And what do you think of in particular when you think of that?
Oh,
what hurts you?
The fact that we're not taking care of it as well as we could, and we're using a lot of the resources, especially in America.
Mm-hmm.
And, our agricultural policies.
What's your fear about that?
Well, it'll be for our children.
For them as it is for us. The earth will be depleted. You have resources for our children, and also have less beauty than what we see and enjoy and live in.
The oppression of the weak.
The oppression of the weak. What weak? Who? Which weak do you have in mind?
Any of the weak. Here,
any of the weak.
Is it Kurds in Iraq, or the Palestinians in occupied territories?
Kurds,
weak everywhere.
The Palestinians, the weak everywhere. Weak in the United States.
Yeah.
Who?
The mentally ill.
The children.
The children.
And the way our government, I'm kind of gluing in on his comment, the way our government seems to be a part of that oppressiveness in some areas, in Central America, or lack of stands that really are with people, such as losing South Africa.
So our own government is implicated in actively oppressing and also in passively oppressing, in the sense that we don't always take a stand against oppression in other parts of the world. You gave Central America as an example of actively oppressing, and South Africa of that passive kind of implicit cooperation and oppression.
And this business that
the Palestinians and Israel is another place where we're involved. Yeah.
I'm really curious that my congregation that I helped to lead raised 3 times the amount for planting grass and sprinkler system, automatic sprinkler system, as it did for hunger in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Hunger in a land of plenty, that is always on my mind. How much food we actually have in this country, and how many people don't have enough food to eat all the time. And right along with that, stereotypes and negative ideas that we have about people who are low income or are on public assistance. That we talk about that, and you see my angry buttons really fast.
In the view of Revelation, all of these things are demonic. They're from this dragon, which is a way of out of control about this. And the book of Revelation is a call for us, in response to this demonic power at loose in the world, to draw lines and to conquer by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of our testimony, and by not clinging to life even in the face of death, if it should go that far. Well, chapter 12, verse 13, when the dragon sees that he's been thrown down to the earth, he doesn't give up. That's not the end for him. He pursues the woman who'd given birth to the male child, still after the ones who speak this alternative vision and who try to live this alternative vision, still after the church. But the woman is given the two wings of the great eagle to fly from the serpent into the wilderness. Eagle wings are another image from the Exodus. God carried the people as on wings of an eagle. So God is on the side of the one speaking out for giving life into the world, who is on the side of life, not on the side of death. And there's a wonderful passage here. The woman was given the two wings of the eagle so she could fly from the serpent into the wilderness to her place where she's nourished for a time and times and half a time. Is this deliberate obfuscation or what? Time is a year, times is 2 years, half a time is half a year, 3.5 years. You remember back in verse 6, the woman fled to the wilderness where she'd be nourished for 1,260 days. And in another place, the length of time of 42 months appears. Those are all equivalent. 42 months is 3.5 years is 1,260 days. And where does that number come from? There is a connection with the wilderness wandering. Someone says the wilderness wanderings has 42 stages in it. Mm-hmm. But that's the new meaning of it. There is another meaning, and this is what it is. At the end of the Old Testament, remember the Old Testament ends with Ezra and Nehemiah coming home from exile in Babylon and rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem and the city of Jerusalem and reestablishing a Jewish community in their homeland. Well, what happens after the end of the Old Testament is that they're conquered by one power after another. Poor little Palestine, through its whole history, is a buffer state, and it's a big power from the east or a big power from the west. Egypt from the west, Assyria from the east, you know, has conquered them one after another. And the same thing happens even when they've reestablished their Jewish settlement back in their own homeland. And so Alexander the Great, the Greeks conquer, and then the successors to Alexander the Great, who are from Syria, conquer. And in that series of kings, there is a king named Antiochus who decided and declared that he was the manifestation of God on earth. And so he added to his name Antiochus the word Epiphanes, just like the liturgical season of the church year that means manifestation. I am the manifestation of God on earth. You all are going to worship me, Antiochus Epiphanes said. And in order to have that happen, he put a statue of himself in the temple at Jerusalem, completely in violation of the second commandment that says not to make any images or idols. And so it completely polluted the temple and was an abomination to the people of to the Jewish people. And it was at that point that Judas Maccabeus and his sons and his brothers and his relatives began guerrilla warfare from the hills outside of Jerusalem and actually expelled the foreign abomination for a time. And for a time they were then a free people again, just for a brief time, because then the Romans came in and took them over. But for a time they were free. And that's the story of Hanukkah, because when they came, when Judas Maccabeus and all the guerrilla warriors who had just gotten Antiochus Epiphanes out of there, when they came back into Jerusalem, the temple was in a shambles, but they wanted to relight the sanctuary lamp, and there wasn't enough oil to even go one day, except miraculously there was a miracle, and it burned for 8 days to reconsecrate the temple. So that's the story of Hanukkah. Well, anyhow, Antiochus Epiphanes, this evil king, ruled for a total of 3.5 years. And then his reign was cut off by this victory. So what does that period of time mean when it shows up in Revelation? It's a heartening reminder to all of us in Thyatira and Sardis or wherever we live that the term of evil must come to an end. remember Antiochus Epiphanes? He thought he was the manifestation of God on earth, and he was out of there after 3.5 years. What do you think that means for Rome, folks? Now, Rome may have a little longer tenure than 3.5 years, but we can be sure that it's going to be a limited tenure. Rome is not going to be ruling forever. Just remember Antiochus Epiphanes. And we have this emperor now, Domitian, who is calling himself Lord and God, putting that on coins and declaring it in his temple in Rome and having us declare it in our temple here in Ephesus or wherever it is that we live. He's not going to last forever either, because just like Antiochus Epiphanes, he's an abomination to God. That's what that period of time signifies to us. And during this time of tribulation and of oppression, God will protect the church, even though this is a wilderness for us. God will protect the church. Now, chapter 13. Oh, and this is the beautiful image I talked about, end of chapter 12. From his mouth the serpent poured water like a river after the woman to sweep her away with the flood, but the earth came to the help of the woman. It opened its mouth, the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from its mouth. Even all of creation is on the side of those who are for life and for peace and for justice. All of creation will help oppose the dragon that's on the side of death and tyranny. Then the dragon was angry with the woman, wonder why, and went off to make war on the rest of her children. Who are the rest of her children? What are the marks of these faithful people? Those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. So, next, chapter 13. The dragon takes his stand on the sand of the seashore, trying another strategy here. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea. In Bible terms, the sea is a place of chaos and disorder, and Jewish people were not sea people, and they were afraid of the ocean. So out of the sea, out of this chaotic place, rises this beast with 10 horns, power, 7 heads, and on its horns were 10 diadems, and on its heads were blasphemous names. Well, Rome has 7 hills. There had been, by some ways of counting, 10 emperors in the Roman Empire up to this time. That and other clues put it together that this is Rome. So the dragon is Satan. The first beast is Rome. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. Old Testament students, you say, oh, in the book of Daniel, there was a series of beasts representing the kingdoms that were oppressing Israel. And this one beast is like all of those beasts in one figure, in one body. This beast is even worse than the ones that they had to deal with back then. It's like all of them wrapped up in one. With those blasphemous names on its head, it is opposed to God. We knew that anyhow. And then, notice, the dragon gave it his power and throne and great authority. In case we didn't know it before, this clearly says, Rome is demonic. It is a gruesome parody of a true kingdom or reign or empire. One of its heads seemed to have received a death blow, but its mortal wound had been healed. This is possibly the civil war that Rome had recently gone through when it wasn't clear who would be the emperor and they competed for about a year before finally someone took hold again. Or it's possibly the emperor Nero, who committed suicide, but he was kind of the Elvis of his day. They kept expecting Nero to come back to life again and rule with the sort of horrible ruling power that he'd had. You know, Nero's going to be back. I don't know if we say, well, we might get another Reagan or something. We might get another Nero. And I like this verse in here. It's a little bit of humor to me because it's kind of saying, you know, Rome is fallible. We're talking about it in this great cosmic way. It's a beast from the sea, but remember, it just about died. Ah, darn it, somehow it didn't die, but, you know, maybe there's chinks in its armor. Maybe there's a weakness from within. In amazement, the whole earth followed the beast. And here the parody to true worship of the true God is laid out in graphic detail. The whole earth followed the beast. They worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" Old Testament students know that there's a psalm that says, or that the Israel said coming out of Egypt, "Who is like the Lord, the strong conqueror?" Well, people are totally confused. They're saying, who's like the beast? Nobody can stand up against Rome. Nobody can stand up against the economic system of the West. Nobody can stand up against the nuclear weapons that the countries have. Nobody can stand up, or can we? And in the next verses, it's clear that this beast is opening its mouth to utter blasphemies against God and is allowed to make war on the saints and conquer them, given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all the inhabitants of the earth worshiping it. Except not everybody. Everyone worships it except those whose names have been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slaughtered. So there are exceptions, and this is here to strengthen our backbone and make us say, you know, everybody else might be being sucked into this, but not us, because from the foundation of the world, from the very beginning, God has wanted us to have another vision and another message, and to proclaim it.
Question?
Yeah.
How do we juxtapose the verse there where it says the beast is given, the dragon is given the beast power and authority? And just juxtapose that against what Paul writes, where authority is given from God, and therefore we should obey temporal authorities.
Mm-hmm. That's Romans 13, and we can look at that. Romans 13. Kind of nice, Revelation 13, Romans 13, easy to remember. Paul says, let every person be subject. He's writing to Rome. He's writing to people in Rome. So this is the Roman government, right? When did Paul write Romans?
Before Domitian.
Before Domitian, before Nero. Let's say middle of the century. Okay. And this is 45 years later that Revelation is written. So the point Paul is writing, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. And then in verse 4, the government authority is God's servant for your good. Now, Paul not only gives the instruction that we're to obey authorities, but tells why. So the question that John would ask Paul is, or what John would not, he wouldn't ask Paul, what John would tell Paul is that, hey, these rulers are now a terror to good conduct. These rulers don't care if... They're promoting, they're the agents of evil in the world, not the supporters of good. They're the ones who are oppressing 95% of the people for the sake of the 5% who are allowed to be free and flourish. They are not God's servant for good. And that is why, Paul, that's why we here in Western Turkey now, 45 years later, are taking a different stand. Because the situation has changed and the government is not God's servant for good. You going to buy that?
Well, so by that, one can't always just take what Paul says and apply that to every government everywhere and every time. Right?
That's what I'd say. Does anybody else want to?
Then you point out John.
Yeah. And it's interesting. You can follow that development through the New Testament, because for Paul, he was saying, yeah, we can. This government can be helpful to us. And in First, it's in one of the Timothys, or it's in First or Second Peter. It's indicated that there's a little more troublesome attitude towards the Roman government and a little more questioning of, you know, how are they treating us and so how should we respond to them? And finally, by the time of Revelation, John certainly has his mind made up. Rome is from the dragon. It's not human. It's not divine from God. It's lost its humanity. It's a beast. This isn't even an evil person that he pictures. Rome is a beast. It's not human. Nothing human left in it. And I think it calls for discernment on the part of God's people to say, so is our government so far gone that it's a beast, that we oppose it this way, or are we talking with something that still has some humanity left in it and can be persuaded and changed?
Even Jesus with a coin said, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's.
And if that's possible, that certainly is preferable. But John's saying that's not possible anymore, because if I do render to Caesar, then I am denying God. In my society, John says, it's not possible to render to Caesar and to God, because Caesar is calling for a choice, one or the other. And since Caesar has made this the choice, then I'm going to choose God.
The question that's been in my mind all through this is, when John wrote this, and it is also figurative, would the people of that time be able to interpret it, as we need help interpreting it? Did it do any good?
How do you think we're doing? My sense is that we're doing okay, and there are some things that confuse us, but we're getting the general drift of it.
Uh-huh. I would think it would be easier for them because they're products of that history, which makes it more difficult for us because we don't know that history.
If, for example, if we talked about this country in cartoon terms, we might talk about the donkeys and the elephants, and we would all know what we were talking about. And 100 years from now, or, you know, we're almost 2,000 years from Revelation, they might not know, but they might be able to figure it out. So I think a lot of the things here would have self-evident meanings to the people who shared that culture. Yeah?
I was going to say that I think that the recent war illustrated to us that there's a whole different mentality that still exists in that part of the world, which is very much more rhetorical than our much more literal vocabulary. I mean, the stuff that was coming out of there from the press was unbelievable. It sounded much more biblical in a lot of ways.
Yeah, the press releases from Iraq that said exterminate the heathen and that kind of thing did sound biblical.
Mm-hmm. John, you made a lot of references here to Old Testament connotations for these things. Were these people in the seven churches largely from Jewish backgrounds, or were they new Christians who maybe wouldn't have had that deep acquaintance with the Old Testament?
That's an open question, but when we think about how Paul did his missionary work, he frequently began by giving talks in the synagogues and gathered some of the people from there. And then one thing that was revolutionary about the Christian community is that it wasn't just Jewish, but it was open also to the Gentiles, in other words, the nations, in other words, people from every ethnic group. And so we assume there was at least a nucleus of people who had read the Hebrew Scriptures. I think also some of the people who became Christians were the God-fearers, people who were attracted to Judaism but hadn't fully been converted or joined as Jews, and they also would have been listening to the Hebrew Scriptures for years, and they're kind of orbiting around the synagogue without really belonging.
It seems to me that for someone to understand this in the way you've been saying, would assume that they're really well versed in the Old Testament.
Yeah, the more you know, the more you hear, mm-hmm. The more it resonates. In verse 11, there is another beast who rises, this one out of the earth, not out of the sea. Two horns like a lamb, but it speaks like a dragon. Exercises all the authority of the first beast on its behalf, and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound had been healed. Who is this second beast?
Priest.
Priests.
Of some
stuff. Who? Christian priests? Jewish priests? Do the Romans have priests? You bet they have priests. They have priests running these temples that they're setting up for emperor worship. Every empire has to have its propaganda machine. And the second beast is the propaganda machine of the Roman Empire, the whole system of priests, and we'll go a little farther. The ones who set up worship of the first beast, who perform great signs, you know the bread and circus idea, keep the masses distracted and happy, in verse 13. Deceiving the inhabitants of the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that had been wounded by the sword and yet lived. Statues of the Roman Empire, coins with images of the Roman emperors on them. And then verse 16, so it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell who does not have the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. The economic system is run by Rome as well. And at the end of verse 15, notice, if you don't worship the image of the beast, you can be killed. This second beast has the authority to do that. This system in our local town here in Ephesus or in Sardis or in Thyatira, wherever we live. The local bureaucracy representing Rome is going to make us do all these things and kill us if we don't. Now, what about the mark of the beast on your right hand? Some people think that might be the coins of the Roman Empire that are the official currency system. Or it might be, as happened in South Africa, that you would be stamped with indelible ink once you had been interviewed and been determined to be no threat to the system. Or it might be like a slave, you were tattooed or branded. Or for that matter, I guess prostitutes wore a sign on their forehead that indicated their trade, so it might mean, and prostitution is a good biblical symbol for someone who's thrown away the true faith and gone over. They're going to be marked by this second beast, somehow identified as part of the system. And then here comes the famous number of the beast. The mark of the beast is 666. Or some manuscripts of the New Testament say 616. What does this number mean? There are a lot of possibilities, and no one has settled on it for sure. But in both Greek and in Hebrew, numbers are represented by letters. And so letters have numerical equivalents. And then you can add up the number of the letter, if you see what I mean, and come up with a sum. So if you take Hebrew and do the name of the emperor Nero, it comes out to 666. And if you take a shortened version of the emperor Nero's name in Greek, it comes out to 616. Now, some people say, why would John, who's been quoting the Old Testament in Greek and apparently doesn't know Hebrew, bother to figure out the emperor Nero's name in Hebrew in order to come up with the number 666? And then there's another possibility, too. Domitian, who we think was the emperor at the time this was written, had five legal names, and if you add up his five legal names in Greek, you come to 666. So there are a lot of possibilities, and you can imagine scholars have had a heyday with this, trying to track down who the 666 is. But even without going through all of that, what does the number 7 mean? Completeness. And here we have this unholy trinity of the dragon and the first beast and the second beast trying to ape God. Not just trying to ape God, but trying to replace God. And falling short, falling short, falling short. 666. Never coming to fullness or completion. This might be one of those wonderful numbers that goes on forever. Not just 666, but 666666666666.666666. Rats, we're out of time. There's so much more in here that's fun to do. But that's all for today, folks.
Thank you, Joel.